Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Culture and technology, from telling time in the ancient Roman world to the cultural significance of ice cream in modern America. Join me now for conversations with Henry Binford of Northwestern University and George Houston of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. First on the program this week, Henry Binford discusses the cultural significance of ice cream in modern America. Later on, you'll hear from George Houston, who will discuss telling time in ancient Roman society. According to Henry Binford, ice cream is a complicated issue, at least to historians. It comes to America with the arrival of English, French, and Dutch settlers in the 17th century. So, although Americans didn't invent ice cream, its origins go back to the time well before recipes, they did invent successful ways of making, keeping, and distributing the stuff. Henry Binford is the author of books about American cities, urban life, and social structures. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a new study about the invention of the slum in the United States. His discussion about the cultural significance of ice cream begins with some economic considerations. Henry Binford.
Well, ice cream was, until the middle of the 19th century, a dish for the wealthy. It was hard to make. It was and is hard to make. It uses fragile and perishable ingredients. It was only available to those who could command natural ice for refrigeration. And that meant people who had servants, basically, and access to ice supplies. What happened in the 19th century was, first of all, the ability to control temperatures better in the beginning through an enormous industry surrounding natural ice, which affected not only ice cream, but food storage and temperature control in lockers for various kinds of things like meat and so forth. Mm-hmm. And in addition, marketing. The appearance of lots of vendors and shopkeepers who wanted a commodity that was relatively healthy, relatively cheap, relatively easy to prepare and portable in a way.
You tie the distribution of ice cream, for instance, Henry Binford, to things like restaurants as they develop in the 19th century,
right.
Taverns,
right.
Bars, soda fountains, all of these networks that you wouldn't normally associate. An ice cream fountain, of course, you would, but not necessarily a bar or mm-hmm, a restaurant. Mm-hmm. What about that?
Well, actually, in some ways, ice cream is an alternative to some of those things, although it appears in them, because... What was the general phenomenon in the 19th century was the appearance of institutions for mass public leisure. Mm. Where people would spend large amounts of time when they're off the job and had disposable leisure time. This in itself is a relatively new thing in the 19th century, and time that was strictly leisure, especially in urban settings. Ice cream is, in a large-scale sense, an urban phenomenon. Mm. And the institutions for mass leisure included restaurants and oyster bars, which also used refrigeration.
Sure.
This is how do you get the oysters from the sea, you know, and so forth. and saloons, beer gardens, all these kinds of things, which we associate with 19th century culture.
Yeah, but they were family alternatives to the saloons and the beer gardens. Have I got that right?
Ice cream was an alternative to restaurants because it was cheap and restaurants were expensive,
yeah.
To saloons because it was respectable, uh-huh. And especially with the mounting power of the temperance movement and the increasing commitment of many, many middle-class Americans to the Cold Water Pledge, ice cream was something they could do, and ice cream parlors were a place they could be and still remain respectable. It's an alternative to oyster bars because you're not likely to get poisoned, which you were likely to get from oyster bars.
Oh, my goodness.
In spite of refrigeration, oysters don't last a long time.
Right.
So there's a niche, I guess we would say nowadays, for the ice cream parlor as it emerges in the latter part of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And also for smaller kinds of production, the old-fashioned ice cream maker, you know, the thing with the two buckets and the crank and so forth, that's an American invention. That device was patented in the United States in the 1840s. We are responsible for giving that to the world.
So it wasn't the Italians, after all, who invented ice cream as we know it now.
No. The Italians make very good frozen confections of all kinds. And in fact, if we want to trace these kinds of things back into the earliest stages of history, the Italians did play a role. We know that there were frozen confections. I won't say ice cream because I think they're more like Italian ices, as we call them, sherbet.
Glacés,
going straight back through the Roman Empire.
Right.
Indeed, there's some evidence that that kind of concoction goes back into pre-literate history.
What about a variant, Henry Binford, like the popsicle? You say something about that here in this piece.
Well, the popsicles and Eskimo pies and all those sorts of things are
goodies on a stick
and goodies in cones are American contributions to world culture as well. The popsicle was invented in one of these fortuitous coincidences by a man who was actually selling refrigerated fruit drinks, left a glass full of one of his wares with a spoon in it on a cold windowsill overnight, and it froze. And in the morning, he grabbed the spoon, yanked the block of frozen fruit drink out of the glass, and eureka! You know, the light bulb went on, and the popsicle was born. This is in the 1920s. Same with Eskimo pie, not quite as fortuitous an invention, but the idea, you know, behind all these things is to enhance the portability, the portable marketability, I guess. It's something you can sell from a cart by a vendor in a crowded sports arena or in a public setting of any kind. Something you can sell in small stores without a lot of hoopla and equipment and preparation.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's portable. People can carry it around when they're in the park, when they're at the amusement park, and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
All these things are eminently suited to the kind of mass public entertainment that was becoming a staple of American culture.
Well, now, speaking of mass public entertainment, Henry Binford, you also talk about ice cream in terms of the world's fairs and the expositions that occurred, mainly at the end of the 19th century and then into the beginning of the 20th in this country. What about them?
In fact, with the popsicles, we were getting a little ahead of that story, because that story of ice cream as part of the grand public gatherings belongs to the World's Fairs. Indeed, the first ice cream soda fountain, the first important one, was opened at the Centennial Exhibition in Philadelphia in 1876.
Mm-hmm.
There was a man named Tufts who opened what he called the Arctic Soda Water Fountain.
Same guys that invented the university?
No, but same family, actually. He was a relative. The other great World's Fairs in the United States, especially the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893 and the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904, were very important in spreading the phenomenon of cheap vendor-sold ice cream among the many concessions at those places were those selling ice cream. Indeed, the World's Fair in St. Louis gave us the ice cream cone.
Mm-hmm. How did that happen? This is not apocryphal. This is you've documented this.
This is not apocryphal, although it is unfortunately an incomplete story. There was a waffle vendor and an ice cream vendor who were adjacent to each other at the St. Louis World's Fair. The ice cream vendor was selling, like all other ice cream vendors, selling ice cream in little dishes or paper cups or whatnot. And he ran out. Lots of ice cream, no containers. The waffle vendor had the brilliant stroke of twisting one of his waffles into a cone shape and baking it hard. Eureka, again, ice cream cone was born. Now, the problem with that story is that we don't know who did it, because there were many ice cream vendors and many waffle vendors, and in the wake of the fair, they all claimed to have done this. But we do know that it happened at the fair, at the St. Louis World's Fair.
Is there a particular population or ethnic group or identifiable section of the American population that outdoes the rest when it comes to the eating of ice cream, do we distribute this?
We are all equally talented. This is one of the few areas, I think, in American culture where you can say it covers every... Every spectrum, every part of the racial, ethnic, economic spectrum. Indeed, one of the things we have done is to make it affordable for everybody. Now, of course, there are high-class ice creams and what you might call street ice creams, but
Haagen-Dazs, for example, is an American phenomenon. It doesn't come from overseas.
That's right. And the name itself is a concoction designed to make it sound highfalutin.
It works.
Yes, and indeed, it is more expensive because it contains more butterfat and more fancy ingredients and so forth. So in that sense, it is quote unquote a better ice cream. But the eating of ice cream, the basic substance, is not confined to any economic group or any race, class, gender.
Do you think that ice cream has seen its day, so to speak? I mean, here we live. We were joking before our taping session about what you called the cholesterol police. Is it really going to melt and go away because of our concerns?
Well, we've been worried about cholesterol now for quite a while in the United States, and it hasn't seemed to have touched the statistics for the marketing of ice cream. It has resulted in the substitution of frozen yogurts and a variety of other things for and low-fat ice creams, and in some ways the modification of the product for those who are susceptible to the cholesterol police, which includes you and me. But it has not changed the basic phenomenon of ice cream worship as it exists in the United States.
Give me a couple of historical examples, Henry Binford. For instance, we associate the name of George Washington with the use of ice cream.
Founder of our country in many important ways, not least of which was that he was an ice cream freak. George Washington, a man with many heavy responsibilities, was very fond of ice cream, and he was a member of the economic group that in those days could afford it. It was his kind of person, wealthy Virginia planter who could afford this sort of thing. Helps a lot if you have slaves to make it for you or servants to make it for you, and who will go and fetch all the ingredients and make sure that they're ready at the proper time and so forth. George Washington also liked to entertain other people, and he ran up some phenomenal bills in the 1780s and 90s, entertaining important Americans and visiting foreigners to impress them with the United States. Ice cream was a tool of state, you might say.
Jefferson enjoyed ice cream?
Yes, and of course, there is a brand name, Dolly Madison Ice Cream, which derives from the habits of the First Lady of that day, because she was one of the first to serve ice cream liberally in the White House as a regular thing, ice cream made on the premises. And Dolly Madison's brand is now a indicator of that.
Well, Henry Binford, it's a pleasure talking with you. You're the author of a piece in the Northwestern University Alumni Magazine, Ice Cream, You Scream, The Cultural Significance of Ice Cream. Thanks for your time, and good luck to you.
A pleasure being here.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Telling time in ancient Roman society, next on Soundings. Listen now for George Houston, a professor of classics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. According to George Houston, the first mechanical clocks were invented about 700 years ago. Thus, the Romans told time with the aid of devices such as sundials. But of the roughly 290 sundials that survive from ancient Roman culture, only two break time down into units of less than an hour. George Houston is the author of studies about ancient technology and history. His interest in telling time in the ancient Roman world covers a period of 500 years, from about 200 BC to about 300 of the Common Era. I asked him to explain. George Houston.
Well, this is the period from which most of our evidence about how the Romans and the late Greeks told time. I think all of our archaeological evidence concerning both sundials and water clocks comes from that period. And such references as we have to them in literature generally date from that period.
Did time weigh heavily on the Roman mind or imagination because they don't have the devices that we have? Did they comment on that? Was there frustration? What?
Well, sometimes it does, but not very often. One of our earliest references to a sundial is a complaint by a man who likes to be invited out to dinner. And he used to, in the old days, before there were sundials, you could show up whenever you were hungry and get fed. And now he complains we can only go eat when the clock says we can go eat. But he's really talking about things that are a lot more vague than we would think about when he says, at a particular time, he means, say, at the third hour of daylight or the fourth hour of daylight, not at 10:15 or something like that.
This is a sort of an inverted Luddite, somebody who's nostalgic for what we now take for granted.
That's right.
What about minutes? How did the Romans think of, conceive, use our notion of what we call a minute, 60 seconds?
Well, so far as I can tell, they didn't think of minutes at all. None of these devices that we know of, and no reference in literature, indicates that there was any standard small unit of time, smaller than half an hour, what we would call half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that their days proceeded in large blocks of time rather than minute by minute, and much less seconds.
Well, so, if a Roman said to another Roman, I'll meet you for, let's do lunch,
right,
let's have breakfast,
right,
how did they agree on when to meet?
Yeah. Well, what a sundial does, of course, is divide the day in, or the hours of daylight into 12 equal parts. And so you would say to your friend, meet me at the 10th hour. And your friend could either go to a sundial and then try to arrive at your house at approximately when the 10th of 12 equal divisions of time was to start.
Right.
Or simply mentally in his head divide the day into 12 equal parts.
Was there a uniformity to this? I mean, here we have that big gizmo out in Colorado that goes tick, tick, tick on shortwave radio. The Romans didn't have anything similar to that, did they?
No, they didn't. No, there's not much uniformity. And in fact, we're given occasionally in literature complaints about how you can't get two clocks, that is to say sundials, to agree. You can get philosophers more to agree more easily, Seneca tells us. And so we also hear that, for example, for a dinner party, people would arrive over a long period of time. And the first guests would be invited in, and they would be given drinks, and they'd take off their shoes, and they would recline. And then it might be what we would call an hour or 90 minutes before the whole party was assembled.
Did they think of this as science? Was this high technology for the Romans in the same way that we think of technology?
Probably the water clocks were. They were relatively rare, and they tended to be used by scientists. Uh-huh. But only four or parts of four water clocks survive out of a period of some 500 years.
George Houston, let me ask you to speculate for a moment. What would the Romans make of our obsessions with time and the way we divide our days, hours, minutes, seconds? Would it be utterly foreign to them?
That is an interesting question, and it does, of course, have to be speculation. My bet is that they would simply not comprehend what we were doing for quite a long time. That they wouldn't really understand if we told them we had these small units of time we called minutes. That just wouldn't make any sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, I suppose we could make them understand that we had settled on standard hours and divided those into certain parts and that we found this useful. I don't think any real Roman or probably anybody who lived before 1200 and probably many people alive today would understand why you would want to do that. Unless they needed to try to measure something because they were themselves involved in science, for example. In that case, they might then get interested in this. One class of such people would be astronomers and astrologers who would want to measure the movements of time. And it's no coincidence that it is in the context of astronomy that we most often hear of the Romans and the Greeks before them using water clocks.
Was time a mystery? Was this one of the areas of our arcana that the ordinary citizen didn't really think about?
Well, of course, you have to talk about two or three different aspects of time. There's the philosophical conception of time in general. And I have left that aside in my studies.
This is far more practical.
Right. I think that what I'm interested in is, yes, the impact upon the everyday life of the fact that there are no minutes.
All right.
And actually, in both cases, I think you're probably right, Wayne, that the ordinary Roman wouldn't have much thought about what time is in a broad context, much less what time is as the day went by. Surely it must have been a sort of natural existence. You'd get up at dawn, you would start about your chores, and we must remember that most Romans were farmers or lived out in the country. Uh-huh. And the cows are going to want to be milked at a certain time, and the chickens are going to need to be fed. And you simply work through this series of natural events, and you notice the shadows getting longer, then you stop.
But the Romans did think during this 500-year time period, George. They did think in terms of weeks and months and years.
Oh, very definitely, yes. There's quite a lot of talk in ancient literary sources about measuring years. Of course, this is the period in which Julius Caesar develops the calendar that, in effect, we still use. Uh-huh. So there's quite an accurate conception of the passage of seasons, weeks, years, and so on. So it's interesting that it's not until about the first century AD that we begin to get clear traces of the seven-day week developing. Earlier on, you have mixtures of sometimes seven-day weeks, sometimes eight-day weeks, sometimes no weeks at all.
That sounds very modern.
And in fact, the rhythm of a Roman's year was determined not so much by a week followed by a weekend as by a long period of work followed by a festival that might last from 3 to 9 days. Huh. And these festivals tend to congregate in certain times of the year when you're not needed on the farm so much.
What about the water supply, George Houston? You've written in this piece that time connects in what way to the Roman water supply?
Well, actually, this is one of the ways I got interested in this, because people who have written about the aqueducts of Rome, actually there's a book, an excellent book on ancient engineering by J.G. Landels, and he commented that it was strange that the Romans never calculated the rate of flow of the water in their aqueducts.
It was just there,
just a lot of water coming in. The best they could do was to measure the size of the aqueduct, but since they didn't have minutes, they couldn't calculate the rate of flow in gallons per minute, for example.
Are we thinking about charging people for water? I mean, what?
Yes, there were.
What's the reason to measure this stuff?
Well, one thing is you'd like to know how much water you have coming into your city. Uh-huh. Yes, and there were provisions for taking water off to private houses, and it might have been possible if you knew exactly how much you were supplying a house to charge them on a gallon per minute basis. In fact, what you do is charge them on the size of the pipe that goes into their house. But according to the pressure, the amount of water they're getting is going to vary considerably.
Well, now, as we move into what the historians call the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. These enormous changes in society and technology, we begin to measure human productivity. Mm. That is to say, how much time it takes to do something and what the output is of one's effort. Did the Romans have analogous thinking in that regard to time?
That's an interesting question. And as far as we can tell, they don't have the idea of productivity that our usage of that word now implies.
So they wouldn't say get the job done in X number of
right, what? Right. We do know they like to make money, and a fair number of them talk about profits and making as much money as you can and that sort of thing. But we do have some references to daily schedules, and they regularly simply mention that something begins at the third hour of daylight or the fourth hour of daylight. They don't seem to break things down any more exactly than that.
Was it an inefficient society, therefore?
I think you could say that in our terms, if uh-huh. you're trying to maximize the use of every available minute of daylight. But it's, again, it's characteristic of pre-industrial societies where, for example, a business transaction may involve haggling and therefore may take a very long period of time. But in that kind of context, it's the social exchange of the haggling that is every bit as important as the actual sale that may or may not finally be made. And that's what gives pleasure, is the social contact. And in that context, whether it takes 5 minutes or half an hour, in our terms, of course, the Romans wouldn't have thought of it that way.
Didn't make any difference. It does make
very little difference. And in fact, the longer it lasts, the better.
Does that mean that the Romans weren't slaves to time in the ways...
It certainly does.
The ways that we are?
Right, yeah. And other people who have studied the development of the clock from medieval times down into early modern times have noticed that we have gradually evolved this time dependency that we have. But it's a relatively recent thing. And I think one of the interesting things is that the Romans fit very comfortably within the context of pre-industrial societies generally in living what we might well call a sort of more natural rhythm and a more natural life, rather than dividing their day into artificial small periods, as we do.
Before our taping session, George Houston, we talked about an ad that you had seen in the New Yorker, a watch for $19,000 that'll run until the year 3000. That really indicates how slavish we are with respect to time.
It's impossible to imagine how that might be useful. Even if one understood what say, a time like 3:27 in the afternoon, we all sort of now agree that that means something. But does it really? Suppose we had started, at a slightly different time, or divided our minutes up slightly differently.
George Houston, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You're a professor of classics at UNC Chapel Hill. The piece that we're talking about is Life Without Minutes. Thanks for coming by the National Humanities Center.
Thank you very, very much for having me, Wayne. It's been a pleasure.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations about technology and culture. My guests were Henry Binford of Northwestern University and George Houston of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. The program number this week is 615. That's program number 615. The National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, Poets and Storytellers. Listen for readings and discussion featuring the North Carolina writers Alan Gerganus and Robert Ginger. You'll also hear from two poets, Lee Young Lee and Jim Wayne Miller. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Old Tech and New, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. From telling time in ancient Rome to the cultural significance of ice cream in modern America. Join me for conversations with George Houston of UNC Chapel Hill and Henry Binford of Northwestern University. Old Tech and New, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.